It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, over 1,500 Wisconsin workers at 83 meatpacking and food processing plants have tested positive for the novel coronavirus. Many of them are Hispanic immigrants. A reporter joins the show for a look at the problem and the response from companies and government agencies. First, 2020 has changed a lot about our lives. One thing has stayed the same. We still need to eat. Seems like a lot of us have been changing up what and how we cook. And on today's edition of Food Friday, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been trying new recipes, or are you being drawn to tried and true comfort foods? What about the seasonal produce booming right now? How are you using that bounty? If you'd usually be going out to eat pretty often, are you trying to recreate any of those meals at home? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Are you finding comfort in cooking? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson loves spending time in the kitchen, and she's with me today to talk about it. Hey, Judith.
Hey, Rob. Good to talk to you.
Now, you find comfort in the kitchen. I think so do I. What have you been doing?
Yes. So it is kind of funny. I think I enjoy cooking more when I want to than when I have to. And it feels like it's been a little more have to in the last few months. We don't generally go out to eat that much, but I feel like we've definitely, you know, we've gotten takeout a few times. But we're definitely eating and cooking at home a lot more. And I do feel like I was getting in some ruts, but I did feel at first like, oh, I'm going to, you know, with working from home and everything, I'm going to do all these really complicated things. And that didn't really pan out yet, at least. But it turns out I am not alone. Andrea Trungale, who's an account executive at Wisconsin Public Radio, said early on in the pandemic, I thought I would use the extra time to experiment and try complex recipes that I don't normally have time to make. But ultimately, as the pandemic goes on, I'm appreciating having more simplicity in my life in general, and I'm seeking out simple recipes with minimal ingredients. And I actually think that that's a pretty common thing. How about you, Rob?
I've tried some new things and some more complicated stuff, but like sometimes the little things, like I've learned to make simple syrups, you know, to make iced tea or to mix into cocktails, things like that, great peach ones. And as always, I'm inspired by Food Friday, so I learned a new peach pie recipe after we did a segment on pies. I'm very suggestible, as you know. So yes. On Food Friday, somebody puts an idea in my head, and then often I'll go home and do it. Desserts I went to right away there, didn't I? Huh. I think that means something, too.
Yeah, maybe that's the comfort part of it. But I do think that I have more time to think about what I'm going to make. It's a little more intentional, I think, because we're also going to the grocery store less frequently. Also, I'm very fortunate I've had the time to spend in my garden, which means that I have a ton of fresh produce right now. Green beans. I planted way too many green beans, Rob, and not just green, yellow beans, purple beans, and green beans. And one thing I've been doing is picking a bunch and then blanching them and using, you know, it in maybe one, two, even three different batches. One thing I did was instead of just thinking of beans as a hot dish, I blanched them and chilled them. And then what I did was I made a simple vinaigrette with good, go ahead and make fun of me, Rob, the fancy French vinegar that you like to tease me about, some good olive oil and some Dijon mustard. Drizzle that over the beans and then put some blue cheese and some walnuts on top. And it's a delicious salad.
And I haven't done that this year yet, making fridge pickles with green beans, blanching them, just like you said, getting some vinegar in the game and then getting them in the fridge. And also I've been trying to take, one of the CSA things where we get produce every week, trying to tackle that right away when I get it on a Sunday. And that part of that has meant making more pesto. And so I'll just take that. And Molly Stentz, by the way, executive producer of The Morning Show, says they've been making so much pesto lately with their basil. And Molly's been experimenting, mixing in a jar of artichokes in the cupboard, making the pesto creamier. And I've been doing similar things like, oh, well, I've got a little of this or a little of that. I'll mix that into the pesto and see what happens. And this is good. I used to think of pesto as this big production. And you could actually, if you got a blender of any sort, you can make it pretty quick.
Well, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you are cooking, or if you need some inspiration, maybe we can help, or maybe another listener can. You know, you talked about the CSA, and that seems like a lot of people are really focusing on helping support local farmers, first of all, because this is a tough time for them, too. Lisa Fisher, who's a director of corporate sponsorship for PBS Wisconsin, said, "Seasonal produce is the wind beneath my wings right now. Just visiting the farmers market in my town is uplifting and stimulates all of the senses." Susan Scott, who's in membership at PBS Wisconsin, said, "I'm loving local organic CSA produce right now." And she says Wisconsin was the start of the CSA movement. I didn't actually realize that.
I didn't either. We are talking on Food Friday about how we have changed our cooking during the pandemic. And we want to hear from you. We'll take your calls in a little bit at 800-642-1234. Have your cooking habits changed one way or another over the last few months? Are you making more complicated stuff, or are you getting back to more simple things? Have you tried new recipes, a new style of cooking, digging into a new cookbook or cooking website? And do you take comfort in cooking? And are you one of the many people who got into, for the first time or back into, baking bread, say, or keeping that sourdough monster that tries to take over your kitchen? Let us know your story, or as Judith said, if you need some inspiration, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we've mentioned a couple people, our colleagues we asked around Wisconsin Public Media. Here's another one. Andy Moore over on the TV side of things, a senior producer over there. He says, Andy says, "I've rediscovered the art of barbecuing ribs like my father did when I was growing up in Kentucky. Northern palates equate rib perfection with the words falling off the bone. Southern grill masters consider falling off the bone to be hospital food." And he says, "I'm getting closer and closer to the Q-fection of low heat, hours, and the resultant and just the right tug off the bone." Yeah, we just talked to a Meathead Goldwyn a while back about making the perfect ribs. I got to stop by Andy's place.
I think Andy should really be delivering, really. Yeah,
that would be the way to go.
So, Rob, you mentioned sourdough starters, and that was kind of a joke at the beginning of the pandemic that all these people were suddenly tending and taming sourdough starters. I have to say that a friend, actually coworker at PBS Wisconsin, Tim Schneider, who is also a friend outside of work, shared part of his starter with me. Rumor has it, I believe it's 34 years old, something like that. Its name is Herman, so I decided that my little part of its name is Hermione. So I have kept Hermione alive now for several months, and I've only made actual sourdough bread a few times because I can't get the timing right of, like, you have to feed it, and then within a certain amount of hours you start the dough, and then it has to sit, and then you have to knead it, and I haven't quite gotten that timetable down. But what I've been using the discard, because you have to get rid of some every week, otherwise it just gets bigger and bigger and you have to feed it more and more, I've been making sourdough crumpets. And they are so good. All it is the sourdough discard. It's a cup of the discard, a teaspoon of sugar, a half teaspoon of salt, and a quarter teaspoon of baking soda. It's based on a King Arthur baking recipe. You do need the little rings that are for English muffins or for crumpets, but it is so easy, and they are so delicious. I've also been making sourdough crackers with the discard. It's equal parts discard and whole wheat flour, some butter, and then you can put any seasoning you want in. Caraway's been a favorite. Herbe de Provence has been a favorite, and they're so good. They're a little more futzy than the crumpets, but... But both are just using the discard that you have to get rid of anyway.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Osceola. Karen, hi.
Hi, Rob.
What do you want to tell us about?
I have to say, this is the first time I've ever called into a radio show.
Oh, welcome.
And I felt like I wanted to tell you, at the beginning of Wisconsin's shelter in place, I wasn't going out to the grocery store, and I decided to institute what I called my daily pantry challenge. So what I had in the bottom of my freezer down in the basement were some frozen beets and some blueberries, and I ended up making blueberry beet muffins that, I know that doesn't sound so good, but they were fantastic.
I disagree, Karen. I love beets. It sounds awesome to me. How much could you taste the beets in the final product?
You know, to be honest, I couldn't taste them that much, Ooh. But I have to say it made the muffin, the interior of the muffin, a delightful pink color.
I was going to say pink and blue. It would be very pretty.
Yes. Yes, and I think young kids would really like this. That might be a sneaky way for moms to get good stuff in little ones.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing that. And I know we've talked about that on Food Friday, Judith, that whole pantry challenge when
yes.
you don't want to go to the grocery store quite as much, or the grocery store might be sold out of the thing, that exact thing your recipe needs. People getting a little more creative with their cooking. I love the blueberry beet muffin concept.
I've actually seen on Facebook people who are doing kind of challenges of what's available commonly in food pantries and really helping people think of creative and healthy ways to use kind of those staples that are usually available. So that's a great idea, too.
Karen, thanks. Welcome to the world of calling into talk shows. Hope to talk to you again in the future. We'll go to Jackie with us now in Sun Prairie. Jackie, hi.
Hello. At the beginning of all of this in March, I bought 9 pounds of spaghetti pasta. And it's weighing down my cupboard as I speak. But I've also read a lot of pasta recipes, carbonaras and all of that kind of thing. And so I decided to experiment. And what I do is shred up a bunch of cheeses that I might have in the refrigerator, put olive oil in it, melt it down in the microwave, and stir that around, dress it on top of pastas, the pasta that I cook up, and then put in the cheese. I also put in a variety of stuff I have in the refrigerator, like oregano and basil, possibly garlic, definitely garlic, actually, and put that in the cheese stuff. And then the trick to this is take the hot pasta and put the cheese, which should be hot, in the pasta and stir it, and then put fresh tomatoes or whatever else I've got that look good. Sometimes I parboil some of that or stir fry it and put it in, and then put Parmesan on top of it. And it's a hearty, tasty meal. Now I've got to start thinking about maybe doing the noodles with some Asian kind of flavors.
Sounds fantastic, Jackie. Yeah. Thanks so much. And that's a great way to use. I mean, now tomatoes are big time around the state right now, Judith. That's a great way to use up a bunch of those, too.
Sounds delicious.
Thank you so much for calling in. We're talking about how pandemic life has changed our cooking, what we've been making this summer. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is with us for this Food Friday conversation. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you have extra time to cook now, are you trying new recipes? Have you gotten into a new style of cooking, a new ethnic cuisine, say, from around the world? Have you found a cookbook that you're digging through, maybe one page at a time? Let us know if you've done something new and different in the kitchen or gone back to something old and comforting. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking about how our cooking has been different this year and what we've been making lately. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is with me, and you can be too if you call in at 800-642-1234. What is different about your cooking this year? Are you trying something new, something old that you're bringing back maybe? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Milwaukee. Dennis, hello.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Dennis?
Well, I got several suggestions here, but number one is if you're afraid of cooking, you get yourself an Instant Pot, and then you go on YouTube, and they will tell you how to do everything, including putting water in it.
Now,
I cook beans at only 30 minutes in my Instant Pot. I make a cheesecake in my Instant Pot. That's 30 minutes, and I can make any flavor except banana. And jam, I cook in a pressure cooker for 1 minute, and then I make my own freezer jam with any fruit except bananas. And pasta in my pressure cooker is only 2 minutes with a half a cup per, there's a ratio in there. But it's all on YouTube, and it shows you everything.
I got to ask that as I can't leave this mystery hanging. I get maybe why no banana jam, but why no banana cheesecake?
Well, I could make banana cheesecake, too. I'm sorry. I said that before, but yeah, I can make banana cheesecake.
Right. Seemed like there was a subtext against bananas right there.
Dennis, thank you so much for sharing that. I know even pre-pandemic, people were really into their Instant Pots. I'm a crock pot guy. I know it's slower. That's what I got, though. I bet a lot of people are getting that one new piece of kitchen gear like that and getting into it, Judith.
I think so. Yeah. And well, for me, it's the crumpet rings. But yeah, and having a chance to kind of experiment. And, you know, I think something that Dennis said rings true for a lot of people. You might have more time now, but maybe for whatever reason, you didn't really learn how to cook when you were young, or it hasn't been one of your responsibilities. And a couple of our coworkers talked about how meal kits can really help. Mm-hmm. Wendy Dwyer, who works in corporate sponsorships for PBS Wisconsin, said she's sight impaired and doesn't drive, and the wait time on grocery delivery services has been a lot longer because of the pandemic. And she found a locally sourced meal kit service. Isthmus Eats inspired her to learn how to make things she would never normally attempt, like chicken tikka masala, Vietnamese beef salad, spanakopita, and other great recipes. And Katie in Audience Services said that pre-pandemic, they rarely cooked. Their teen children would complain about it. And her mother-in-law announced in March that she was going to subsidize a home meal kit subscription. And they were so happy with it. They're preparing complex meals. And the kids are saying, while these dinners have been good, you guys should open a restaurant.
We actually have also done a locally sourced meal kit. And sometimes the grown-ups make them. But the kids, our teenagers, have been cooking. They've cooked some stuff themselves, but it's great. They're learning how to make all kinds of different stuff, including that chicken tikka masala,
nice.
Strangely enough. Let's go back to your calls now. Lorraine is with us in De Pere. Lorraine, hi.
Hi. I have always loved Chinese food, but during the pandemic, especially at the very beginning, all of the Chinese restaurants in my area closed, and I just had to have hot and sour soup. So I went online on Google, and a lot of recipes come up. So the first time I made it, it didn't turn out as good as the restaurant, but it was edible. And the second time it was better, and now it is delicious. So you can learn that. And egg rolls, too. They're delicious.
Wow. So egg rolls, Lorraine, I hear that. I think, oh, that's hard. I would have a difficult time making them. Is it as hard as I think it is?
It's time-consuming, but it's not hard. You have to take the little glob of food and put it in the wrapper and then tuck it in like you're wrapping or swaddling a baby is kind of a good example. So I'm swaddling my egg rolls.
That sounds great, Lorraine. I worry, Judith, because I'm bad at folding and rolling. I can't fold a clean burrito to save my life.
Then you might not be up for the egg rolls. We make homemade spring rolls, so not fried, but the fresh rice paper wrapper, and they're delicious. The big tip there is don't overstuff it because it will not stay in, and you'll have an explosion.
That sounds great, Lorraine. Thank you so much. It's Food Friday. We're taking your calls about how your cooking has changed during the pandemic. If you're trying something new or going back to something old, you can join in on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Arlene is with us in Burlington. Arlene, hi.
Hello there. I wanted to share. We live in a farming community, and one of my farming neighbors started a book, a group on Facebook called What's Up Buttercup, and it has expanded so that if you try a recipe, you put it on Facebook, you put the recipe, you put a picture, and then everybody comments on it or tries it. She has an index group, so if you want to do, like, there's an awesome brownie mix in there, you make it all in a saucepan and just pour it in the pan and put it in the oven. So anyway, I want to make brownies, I go to desserts, and there's a picture of the brownie, and your neighbors have tried and true recipes from all the grandmothers and mothers, and it's just a good way to share neighbors' recipes, and you know they're going to be good.
And Arlene, does it make you feel like you're in touch with your neighbors, even if maybe you couldn't see them like you usually could?
Oh, yes, because, you know, maybe you don't know this person, but they commented on somebody else that you knew, and so it's like a community, but we're all at home, practically.
Fantastic. So. I love that, getting
that
the community
great.
Together, Judith.
Yeah, I love that. And I love being able to share recipes or tips or having other people. I have to say, I was thrilled to see so many of our coworkers send ideas of things that they're cooking because it's giving me all these great ideas, including you're going to hold me to this, Rob, okay? So check in with me in a couple of weeks. Clarissa in Audience Services said she's been making her own simple cheeses this summer.
Wow.
Queso Blanco in particular is pretty easy to make at home, she says, and it's great to snack on or use as a topping on lots of different dishes. And that reminded me that Inga Wischer, who does the Around the Farm Table show on PBS Wisconsin, when she was on Larry's show, she shared a super easy recipe for making homemade ricotta cheese. I dug it up at WPR.org, and I'm going to try it.
Sounds fantastic. Thanks a lot for that call. Sandy is with us now in Green Bay. Sandy, hi.
Hi. So I love your previous caller who was talking about how she does spaghetti stuff. And it reminded me of the Japanese wafu pasta, where they take, the traditional traditional Italian pasta, and they put a Japanese spin on it. So definitely look that up. But the Japanese cooking is what I've kind of really been getting into over the summer. And it's just really interesting to learn about other food cultures and, you know, why they do what they do. And
Sandy, what's the favorite dish you've made from Japanese inspirations?
They have something called donburi, which is basically a rice bowl. And so you have all of these elements that you put in these meals, and it's, you know, taste and colors and methods of cooking. It's called wishoku. And it's just really interesting. And so all of these elements are always in their food. And, it's like it's all about balance and harmony and all of that stuff. So it's really interesting.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that, Sandy. I appreciate it. Judith, less than a minute left. Which inspiration are you going to take from our coworkers or our callers and make this weekend or soon?
Oh, man. Oh, well, actually, Lori Skelton, WPR music host and frequent Food Friday guest, says she lives in Madison. Her boyfriend lives in Milwaukee. They get together on the weekends, but they haven't shared a kitchen since March. And she shared Nigella Lawson's slow roasted garlic and lemon chicken recipe with us, and she said it's become their go-to dinner. It's easy, doesn't need to be watched, and she can send the leftovers home with him so he has an edible reminder of something shared. And I'm going to try that this weekend.
That sounds fantastic. Judith, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Always fun, Rob.
And thanks for all of your calls as well. You can keep sharing over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what new thing you are cooking in this weird time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter who's been closely following the outbreaks of COVID-19 in the state's many food packing and processing plants. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission demoted Police Chief Alfonso Morales to captain last night. We'll learn what led to the decision and what's next for that department. First, over 1,500 Wisconsin workers at 83 meatpacking and food processing plants have tested positive for the novel coronavirus, including 8 who died, according to state data. Many of those victims are immigrant workers. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has spent the past few months interviewing employees at 5 of those food plants and digging through public records to try to understand more about how the outbreaks escalated. Maria Perez is an investigative reporter covering immigration and social services at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Maria, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
When did food processing plants in Wisconsin start to emerge as a public health problem, as possible hotspots for COVID-19?
The first cases that we know of happened in late March, but back then those cases hadn't really been reported about. There was no public knowledge of them. It was in mid-April to late April when the outbreaks had grown by a lot and workers started to talk with the press, and some public health authorities started to release some data that we really started to learn about the outbreaks and how big they were.
And your piece follows the story of Alberto Martinez, who worked at a meat plant in Pleasant Prairie. Can you share his story with us?
Yes. He worked for a meat packing plant. He was an immigrant from Mexico who was planning to return after saving enough to help put her daughter through college, one of his daughters. And when Wisconsin went into lockdown, he kept going to work because he was considered an essential worker. A couple of weeks after that, he died of COVID-19. I spoke with a coworker of his, and I also got a message that was sent to the Department of Health that day of Kenosha County. Both the message and the worker said that by that time, the company was lacking very important safety measures against COVID-19.
And can you talk about how food processing and meatpacking plants responded? When did we start to see any kind of changes when it came to safety measures?
In some cases, many of the safety measures came after the first workers started to test positive. What we saw is that many of the important safety measures that the companies adopted came weeks after the epidemic started, and in some cases, even weeks after the first cases, the first workers tested positive.
And one thing that I wasn't aware of, at some of these meat plants, they actually have barracks, in effect, for their workers. So not only do you have people working next to each other, they might be sharing these large barrack bedrooms together. Was that part of the problem here, that these people were at close quarters literally day and night?
That company was a food processing company. They processed frozen vegetables. The workers said that they were, many of them, sharing barracks. And three workers told me that there was a worker who seems he was sick and he was sharing the barrack. They were in, and they reported him. They told someone who was in charge of housing that he was sick, but he was not isolated until about a couple of weeks after. And after that, some workers tested positive. Now, the company said that, disputed that account and said that any worker who showed symptoms was isolated in separate housing. But what we know is that there are many of the workers who were in those barracks. They tested positive, or at least they said they tested positive.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Maria Perez from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at early COVID-19 outbreaks at meatpacking and food processing plants around Wisconsin. And Maria, a lot of the workers you talked to and some other sources have talked to have said companies were too slow to bring in safety measures. Was that a pretty common concern you heard from people?
Yeah, that's a very common concern that I heard from workers, that by the time the measures were in place, many of them were already sick. That's something that is a common theme in the testimonies of the workers that I have spoken with. Now, the company said they were doing everything as fast as they could. They were not having face masks at the beginning, but our workers that it was way too slow.
Some workers brought complaints to the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Did they get much of a response from OSHA?
Well, OSHA has opened some investigations, some inspections, but OSHA did not start opening inspections, on-site inspections, until April 20th. So an analysis that we did of OSHA data showed that they had received COVID-19 complaints about food processing facilities nationwide since mid-March, but they didn't start to open inspections until late April. And what was very revealing for us is that they received two complaints about the safety measures in the Smithfield Cuda hay plant. And they actually called them and they learned that the company had not made any changes to separate workers on the floor and that the company was not distributing face masks. And instead of opening an inspection, they closed the complaint and they gave some information to the company about COVID-19. Now, after that, and after the paper reported on concerns from workers, OSHA opened another investigation that is still open, but at that time they closed it. At that time, though, the CDC was not recommending masks, but they had already said that companies should try to social distance the workers.
What was the response from local health departments when these localized outbreaks were happening?
What I've seen is that they mostly did some contact tracing and try to test the workers. But although, for example, the city of Milwaukee Commissioner of Health closed a couple of plants at least when there were cases, most of the other health departments seem to not have taken a similar decision. So they did not mandate safety measures. They did not close plants unless the plants made sure some measures were in place. And sometimes they actually they struggled at times to get the collaboration from companies. The CUDA health officer was trying to partner with Smithfield to test workers with symptoms because they heard that they were having barriers to tests. And Smithfield took at least 3 days to give the green light to say that, yes, they were interested in partnering with them. So it was... the actions that were taken were mostly in the advisory side of it, providing information and guidance and testing and contact tracing, but not in the enforcement side of it of taking more aggressive measures.
I know around the country this has been an issue, and another issue has been whether the government is working with plants to provide specific data and numbers about cases within plants. What's going on in Wisconsin now? Do we have data on outbreaks at these plants you're covering?
Oh, my God. That has been one of the biggest struggles during this, trying to cover this. The state gave me some numbers of workers who had been infected in meatpacking plants and in food processing plants, a number of plants with outbreaks, but they have never given me a breakdown of cases. I've made public records requests. I've asked for that information. They have not provided it to me. I've asked county and city health departments for that information. Sometimes after asking a few times and writing a story about the fact that they were not providing that information, making a public records request, sometimes I was able to get information, but other times counties have just plainly refused to provide information. And of the companies that I have asked, there's only one, Conagra Brands, that provided information about the number of workers who were infected, which was 221 out of more than 800 workers that they had in their dairy plant, but none of the other companies have told me. So there is a big issue in transparency, and right now there could be an outbreak in some other meatpacking or food processing plant or some other factory, and we would not know because no one is providing an update on the numbers either.
Maria, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maria Perez is an investigative reporter covering immigration and social services at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about her investigation into COVID-19 outbreaks at food processing plants around Wisconsin. We've got a link to her story at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, Milwaukee Police Chief Alfonso Morales was demoted last night to captain after unanimous vote by the city's Fire and Police Commission. We'll learn why and what's next for the department at a time when policing has the public's attention. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, NPR's Hanzi Lo Wong joins us for an update on the 2020 census. Now, the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission took actions last night against the city's now former police chief, Alfonso Morales. Here's Commission member Raymond Robakowski.
I'd like to make a motion to demote Alfonso Morales to the rank of captain, his original rank before becoming chief, immediately.
After unanimous vote, the chief lost his leadership position. Our guest has been watching the back and forth on this issue and is here to share some context of the vote. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety, crime, and policing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
This is not something you see every day, Ashley. What were some of the reasons that members of the commission gave for demoting former Chief Morales?
I think the overwhelming theme last night was the commissioners feel and they felt and they continue to feel that Chief Morales did not fulfill the job as he said he would do it. He accepted his reappointment with some pledges to be strict on discipline, to give more information to the commission, to be more responsive to the community. And it was clear last night that the commission felt he had not followed through with those promises.
And there had been, a feud kind of between the chief and a key member of this fire and police board. Can you give us some background on that?
Sure. The word feud was actually used by Mayor Tom Barrett yesterday. Actually, the phrase blood feud was used to describe the souring relationship between Chief Morales and the chairman of the board, Stephen DeVogus. It seemed like really some of these problems stemmed back in the fall. Chief Morales has since made it known that he believed that the chairman wanted him to fire a specific officer involved in the arrest of Milwaukee Bucks player Sterling Brown. He had refused to do that, instead handing out other punishment. Steve DeVogus has denied that he ever put forward he ever had this conversation with the chief. And then in December, DeVogus, as chairman, who can call meetings and cancel meetings, began to cast doubt on whether the commission would vote on the reappointment before the chief's interim term expired. And then around that same time, the Journal Sentinel obtained a video of the chairman, who is an attorney, accompanying a real estate developer who was being interviewed in a sexual assault case. And in fact, during that interview, the detective commented on how odd it was to be doing the interview with the chairman there, seeing as he was basically his boss. And then tensions continued to ramp up this spring when the commission repeatedly canceled meetings, and then it sort of escalated a couple of weeks ago when the commission handed down this very detailed list of directives and, explicitly said that the chief faced discipline up to and including termination if he did not follow them.
And what was his response to those directives between then and yesterday?
So Chief Morales, these directives required public explanations of different investigations, ongoing criminal cases, misconduct cases, and discipline, as well as updates on hiring and promotions and other things. Former Chief Morales, he said he was complying with the directives. However, his department also released a rebuttal report of sorts on Wednesday evening, basically saying that although they were complying, they felt that there were that these directives were legally dubious and that they contained factual errors as well, and that they had actually already provided some of the information being requested.
I want to give a listen to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett reacting to last night's vote.
The discussion surrounding this decision tonight was completely lacking in transparency. The action taken by the commission tonight was not good government.
And people might be surprised, the mayor in this case is not the boss of the police chief who can hire and fire police chiefs. It's this commission. So what role does Mayor Barrett play in all of this?
So Mayor Barrett obviously has a strong voice as mayor of the city. He is the one who puts forward appointments to the Fire and Police Commission, and those appointments have to be confirmed by the Common Council. But he does not have the power to remove anyone from the commission, nor does he have the power to hire or fire the police chief. The one thing he could have done was veto some of these directives. That is allowed under state law. However, he said that Morales had not requested him to do that.
Talking to Ashley Lutheran from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission's decision to demote former police chief Alfonso Morales to captain. Is there talk of former Chief Morales challenging this decision in some way?
There is. You know, in the run-up to this meeting, it seemed clear that tensions were high and that the chief was consulting with legal counsel, including prominent attorney Frank Gimbel, who actually was retained by the previous police chief, Ed Flynn, when he was facing some conflict with the commission. And, you know, they've basically said they would be considering all options if he were to be disciplined or fired. And he essentially was both last night. He was removed from his position and demoted. So they have not ruled out things such as a lawsuit, or perhaps, you know, there's questions as to whether or not he could appeal to circuit court to see if his firing was legal.
And then what happens now with the immediately opened job of police chief of Milwaukee?
So unlike the last time there was an opening at the police chief position in Milwaukee, the Fire and Police Commission moved very quickly to name an acting police chief, and they went down the chain of command. They selected Michael Brunson, who was sworn in this morning. Brunson was actually the finalist with Morales for the interim police chief job back in 2018. And so he, as of right now, is conducting the day-to-day business of running the police department.
So it's a weird position to come into a job after the ousting of your predecessor and police getting a lot of attention, obviously, over protests, Black Lives Matter protests. What is the atmosphere like now for a new leader of the Milwaukee Police Department?
You know, as my colleague Elliot Hughes wrote today, Chief Brunson is coming in and he's facing a lot of challenges. And, you know, community groups have released statements throughout the day saying, you know, community groups that have supported the removal of former Chief Morales are coming forward and saying that is not enough. We continue to call for reallocation, removal of money from the police department budget and reallocating it. They're continuing to call for more community involvement in the police department, more reform to the police department, and better community policing all around. And so not only that, he's going to have to continue to prepare for a virtual DNC, but there still could be some sort of public safety concerns related to that. If there are further protests, that's coming up very quickly. There's still a wave of retirements continuing to happen, and that has been ongoing for several months. And so there are a lot of challenges. And to be perfectly frank, we still don't know if those directives apply to Chief Brunson.
Now there's an acting police chief. Is there a timeline in place for a permanent hire now for this this job?
So far, the Fire and Police Commission has not indicated how that process will unfold. It is up to them to run such a search. Typically, the executive director of the commission, who is a member of the mayor's cabinet, typically that position would do a lot of work coordinating that. The current executive director, Griselda Aldrete, has withdrawn from reappointment consideration. And so it's not quite clear to me, at least at this particular moment, if that search will launch before her replacement is named, or if they will move forward with setting out the parameters for finding a new permanent police chief before the executive director is replaced.
Wow, there's a lot of moving parts here, Ashley. What are you watching for next in this story with all this going on?
I think the next developments will be to see if former Chief Morales decides to pursue any legal action related to his demotion, and to see whether or not the Fire and Police Commission is going to actively, quickly move to lay out a process for finding a new permanent police chief.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ashley Lutheran. She covers crime and policing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She brought us the latest on the decision yesterday by the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission to demote a former now police chief Alfonso Morales to his older position as a captain within the police force. Well, if you have thoughts on this, if you're in Milwaukee in particular, we would love to hear what you think. If you're a stakeholder or a concerned community member, share your thoughts with us. You can email us. You can always email us. ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. What do you make of this change at the top of the Milwaukee Police Department? What are you hoping comes up next? Email ideas@WPR.org. Here's some food news that's out there. The Kraft Company is trying to rebrand their mac and cheese as a breakfast food. Maybe it's for real, maybe just a publicity stunt, but one thing that's for sure, some of us here at Central Time have eaten some unusual foods for breakfast over the years, including producer Bill Martins. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Rob.
Now, you and I have both worked early morning media shifts, you even earlier than me at some points in your career. Have you tackled some weird foods for breakfast in that time?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I remember, so I used to work a graveyard shift at a TV station in Wausau before I came down here. This was like 15, 18 years ago. And I remember a couple of times, you know, I would be done doing everything in the studio. It'd be like, you know, when the daytime reporters were coming in, and I'd be just munching down a hamburger. And people would be like, how can you eat that right now? And I'm like, it's easy. I mean, I've been up since like 11 o'clock last night.
Now, this is a philosophical question, though, Bill. It was in the morning, so did that make it breakfast? But is at the end of your shift, does that make it dinner? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to raise that question with you. I hope you'd have the answer, but clearly you don't.
Well, I have no answers, Bill. But I have in my life, especially in my youth, done the old, you know, literally breakfast. You get up and eat the, you know, the cold pizza from the night before. Have you ever been there?
I've never done the cold pizza thing. Pizza I have to have warmed up. I could probably do pizza in the morning, but not cold.
Quick answer here. Mac and cheese for breakfast, hot or not?
Not.
Not. Well, there you have it.
This is
this is Central Time on the Ideas Network.